Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. In his new book, While Reason Slept, Thomas Breyer Jr. tells the story of the nation's founding principles and how the men who wrote the Constitution envisioned government for the common good. He writes that the Constitution has been eroded by self-interest, consumerism, and propaganda. Joining us is Thomas Breyer Jr., author of the book. Mr. Breyer, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back, Scott. Thanks for having me again.
So why did you write this book?
Well, there, I wouldn't point to one specific point in time. For the past year, I kind of started reading a lot about the founders and the philosophies that are really the underpinnings of the Constitution. And the more I read, the more I realized that there was a lack of awareness, particularly among my generation, as to what the ideological
Your generation.
Origins, meaning that the millennials.
Okay.
Yep. Just, you know, 20s, 30s, people who grew up in the post-Reagan era, I would say. And there just seemed to be a general lack of awareness as to what really the purpose of government was for the founders. And so the more I read, the more I kind of thought to myself, well, I think this is enough to put into a thesis. And so my purpose in writing it was to really provide not only my friends and those I interact with kind of an explanation as to what the philosophy of government was for the founders, but to engage in a conversation with, you know, people like you about what we can do to kind of rectify some of the problems that have gone wrong.
So what were the philosophies of the founders? I mean, what were their guiding principles?
So it's fascinating, really. When you read the pamphlets from some of the founders, you know, Jefferson, Adams, Franklin, they studied two groups of people, really. The first were philosophers that were alive during the fall of Rome. Plutarch, Livy, Cicero, and they resonated with the founders because they were dealing with tyranny from Britain. And so they were trying to figure out, how do we deal with this? What does this look like? What does a correction require? And what do we have to do? And they literally revolted. I mean, think about how profound that is, to revolt against something that you believe so strongly in. And so they looked at what the philosophy was from the Romans who wrote at the time. And then they also looked to more contemporary writers. And this is Enlightenment rationalism. And there were three writers in particular who I would say had the biggest influence on them. The first was Thomas Hobbes. And Hobbes had a very cynical view of human nature. He thought that people were pretty much governed by self-interest and the passions. And he had a pretty profound effect on some of the founders. The second was John Locke, who had the opposite approach. He said human beings aren't born one way or the other. His phrase was tabula rosa, a blank slate. And if you have a virtuous society, you can create virtuous citizens. And that was the view that they ultimately subscribed to. And then the third was Montesquieu, who really was more of a political philosopher. And from him, they learned that if one man were left to oversee and act and carry out every law, that would be the end of everything. And so from that, they implemented the three branches of government that we live with today.
You know, it's interesting that something you said that I want to say that I don't know if it's an exaggeration to describe what was happening in the colonies at that point as a good thing, but I don't want to say they had a good thing going, but most of the people that we consider the founders consider themselves British citizens.
They did.
And that they knew that they had the strongest military power in the world protecting them. Yes, they were not happy about taxation and a lot of other things, but it took a lot for them to revolt against the strongest country in the world. And then they did start from scratch and come up with their own country. But it's interesting that they relied on what they had read from those philosophers that you mentioned.
It's stunning. The book that really was the main reason I wrote this was Gordon Wood, who's probably the leading historian for the Revolution. He wrote The Radicalism of the Revolution, is what he called it, because it was radical for a group of people to be part of a government, to be so profoundly aware that what was going on was wrong, and then at the same time also see through education what justice really looked like. You know, what was the ideal and what did that require? And to believe in something so deeply that you're willing to risk your life for it is really the ultimate sacrifice. And so the fact that these people existed at the time when tyranny had taken over in the colonies is quite remarkable.
You mentioned education, and that was one of the tenets of the common good. Let's talk about this overall, though, before we get into education specifically. Those who wrote the Constitution that we refer to as the Founding Fathers envisioned a government and a nation of people who worked toward the common good. Explain that.
A nation of people who work toward the common good is the first prerequisite of democracy, because if you're implementing a system of government that relies on, I mean, think about it, it's really for the first time in human history that you're allowing the citizens to choose their own destiny. You're giving the power to the people. The power doesn't exist in an aristocratic form or some kind of blood lineage. You're giving the power to the people. And if so, if the people have the power, if they can control their own destiny, then that requires one, to reason through problems, and that only comes through education, and two, to look out for one another. The common good really is—it's not just words. It has a really specific meaning. It's for democracy to flourish. We have to look out for one another, and we have to execute our duty as citizens. And one of the things actually you and I talked about last time was this is the first time the word citizen has been applied in the public realm. If you look back to ancient Athens, the word citizen was conferred upon those who were in nobility. But in America, citizen is given to you by birthright. And that is not only a title, but it's a duty. You have a responsibility as a citizen to look out for other people. And the founders used that word with a very specific meaning. And like you said, it was geared toward the common good.
All right, so the common good. You write in the book that there are many examples of that in early America. But all along the way, though, there were probably those who Hobbes described as those who were looking out for their own self-interest, that were very interested in acquiring material things. Talk about that a little bit. The common good and how it changed over time.
Well, this to me is the most interesting part about my research of the Revolutionary Era, because during the Constitutional Convention, the founders debated at length whether human beings were capable of self-government. And there were basically two sides to that. Alexander Hamilton was persuaded by Hobbes. You know, he saw from Hobbes that life is difficult, especially back then. I mean, it was very daunting to deal with even just daily tasks. And to require an entire country to look after not only themselves but for one another, for Hamilton, just was irrational. He said, we can't expect people to do this. It's enough to just work for yourself. We can't impose this additional burden. And so that's basically what Hobbes said. He said, people are governed by self-interest. They're looking out for themselves. And that has to be the foundation upon which you look at government, because if you operate from the wrong premise, government won't work. Obviously, that didn't prevail. The other side of the coin was John Locke, who, as I mentioned, started with that blank slate idea that if you have, you know, people aren't born racist, they're not born misogynist, they're not born any particular way from the start. Instead, it's the society, it's the environment around you, it's your upbringing, it's your education, it's the experiences that you have that ultimately create the person that you become. And so that was ultimately the most persuasive view for the founders. They decided if we prioritize education, if we prioritize the common good, and we create a society that has those as its primary tenets, democracy can work. And so it's really that emphasis on creating the virtuous society, because from that comes the ability to govern yourself.
Are there examples?
I'm sorry?
Are there examples of this virtuous society that they envision?
No. there may be at certain times, but I think, and they realize, actually Washington realized this basically from the beginning, is there's a big difference between political philosophy and theory and governing. Because life is hard. You know, it takes so much time. Think about, we've had, the beauty of this system is that we've been able to progress. But it's been slow, and it's required a really concerted effort and remarkable leaders to get us through really difficult times. But although we haven't reached the ideal quite yet. We do have the ability to reach it. And I think ultimately that's what they intended.
Amongst those group of founders, were there those, though, who lived by what Locke had written? I mean, I think of Washington. Washington is an icon in this nation and really around the world. Was he someone, or were there other founders that believe that if I'm going to talk the talk, I've got to walk the walk?
George Washington was the leading example of that. He personified what it meant to be a leader in early America. In his first valediction to the public when he was president, the first thing he spoke about was public education, how the ultimate or the most important thing in society was knowledge, was the accumulation of knowledge, because through that is the ability to understand what problems are and then to rectify them. And obviously, you know, one of the issues that underlie this entire era is the issue of slavery. That's the country's original sin. And so, you know, I don't think you can say anyone was perfect, because with that background, it's so deeply problematic that the country literally almost collapsed because of it. But through education, you know, Washington actually freed his slaves at the time of his death, and so did Benjamin Franklin. They read about the how horrible slavery was, and they were dedicated to learning constantly. They were not dogmatic. In fact, they were allergic to dogmatism. And so Washington really set the tone from the beginning by prioritizing education. And although his goal of, you know, public universities and national land grants to allow people to pursue a common education were never realized, at least during his presidency, it did create an enthusiasm in America writ large to create these common school and public school movements.
There's some irony, and some would say some hypocrisy, in Washington. As you said, he did free his slaves upon his death, his slaves,
right,
not his wife, Martha, who actually had more slaves. But he waited until he died to do that. So, you know, while he's talking about this, and you know, words that were written into the Declaration of Independence in 1776 about all men created equal.
It's not true.
Yeah, Washington, so even though he may be the best example, he also didn't live that life.
No, I think that's a great point, Scott. It's a perfect example of the fact that human beings are fundamentally flawed. And even those who in their own era might be the epitome of virtue, a century later might be looked at as completely different. And we view their actions through the lens that we live with today. But I think the beauty, and actually, if your listeners have a chance and they're at home, I would encourage them to look up the speech that Barbara Jordan gave during the opening of the Nixon impeachment proceedings in 1972. Because she talks about, she's an African-American woman, and she said that when the Constitution was originally written, I was not included in We the People. George Washington must have forgot about me. But over time, through a dedicated pursuit to the common good and through reason and the ability to listen to other people's experiences, Barbara Jordan explained that I am now part of We the People, and I uphold the Constitution because I believe in it fully. And I think that the beauty of the Constitution is that it allows society to progress and make those changes that are necessary over time.
The title of the book, While Reason Slept, and we're going to talk about that premise, Reason Sleeping, not using reason. But let's talk about reason itself. Where does the word reason come into the founding of this country, the philosophy behind its government, the experiment, reason?
Well, one of the quotes that I chose as a chapter quote in the book is from Dostoevsky, who wrote in The Underground Man that reason only knows what it has succeeded in learning. You can only reason about things you've been taught about. You know, I can't come in here and tell you what, you know, how you should do your job, because I don't know. You know, I can't, my friends make fun of me for being a terrible golfer. You know, I can't go out on the course and decide whether to hit a 9-iron or a 3-iron because I don't know anything about golf. But you are able to reason through things that you've been taught. And so the founders realized that and this is during the Enlightenment era, obviously, where reason is really the calling card for how to live your life. If you're supposed to reason your way through problems, then you must be taught the foundation that allows you to reason. And so while reason slept is really my way of saying that we've lost that focus on education. we've lost that really dedicated pursuit to statecraft, which is requires a very dedicated focus on learning things that you don't know. You have to be comfortable with admitting your own flaws and admitting things that you don't have knowledge of. Because ultimately, knowledge is a paradox, right? The more you know, the less you know, the more aware you become of your own shortcomings. And so reason, in that sense, is synonymous with education.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Thomas Breyer, Jr., author of the book While Reason Slept. And I want to talk about the two people who play prominent roles in your book, Edward Bernays and Dale Carnegie. Now, a lot of people may be familiar with Carnegie, but who was Edward Bernays?
Edward Bernays, this is so fascinating to me. It's really the most interesting part of the book, in my opinion. He was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. And he was a PSYOPs soldier in World War I who was responsible for carrying out America's propaganda mission in Latin America. And he learned through Sigmund Freud how to manipulate the masses. He's really the first person in human history to figure out how to manipulate millions of people through the proliferation of media. And he was stunningly successful in doing that. And he saw during the armistice when Woodrow Wilson was carried around across the country, how successful his efforts were. I mean, there really was a profound awareness across the country with what America's purpose was in carrying out the war. And that was in large part because of Bernays. And so Bernays, after the war, applied these same lessons in the business sphere, in the political sphere, and his approach was actually adopted, and we can talk about this a little bit too, by Adolf Hitler. In the political sphere, the first example was Calvin Coolidge, who didn't have a great image in society. He wasn't regarded as being very charismatic. And so he hired Bernays. Bernays went out and he said, listen, people are irrational at heart. They don't think with their head, they think with their gut. And what we have to do is to make politics entertaining. We have to entertain these people to make them like you. And so he brought in stars from Broadway, and they had this big party on the White House lawn. He arranged for photographers to come from the New York Times, and he captured the moment. And a jolly Coolidge is out there laughing with all these celebrities, and his picture is published on the front page the next day. And that really changed his image in the minds of Americans, and he went on to win that election by 25%. And so Bernays, reflecting on that after the fact, said that, I learned that politics is really all bombast and celebrity. People don't care so much about what your ideas are for government as they do about enjoying the political process. And the purest form of enjoyment is entertainment. And Bernays learned that. He also applied these lessons in the business sphere. One of the stories I talk about in the book was how he was hired by the American Tobacco Company. George Washington Hill was the president at the time of the American Tobacco Company in 1929. And he said, we need to convince more women that they need to smoke. And I think it was only 12% of women smoked at the time. And so what Bernays did was he reached out to leaders of the feminist movement, Ruth Hale in particular, and he said that, you know what you should do is you should light torches of freedom as a fight against, you know, male dominance and sex taboos. And during your marches, you should smoke cigarettes. And she did. And within months, every theater in New York City had opened its doors to women smoking cigarettes, and the number of women smoking cigarettes had nearly doubled. And again, Bernays said, I learned that age-old customs could be broken down through dramatic appeal through the proliferation of media. And then finally, and this is actually horrifying, during World War II, President Roosevelt considered reaching out to Bernays to help convince Americans to support the war effort. And he actually received a letter from Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, who said, do not do that. This man is fostering fanaticism, and it will ultimately lead to our demise. And so President Roosevelt said, okay, I won't do that. But Joseph Goebbels, who had read Bernays' book, Crystallizing Public Opinion, and who led the propaganda department for the Third Reich, did find Bernays' approach to be persuasive. And they literally adopted his techniques to create a fur cult around Adolf Hitler. And it was Bernays' methods, this fundamental belief that human beings are irrational. You have to convince them through emotional appeal to support your message. And Bernays learned that Joseph Goebbels had taken his lessons later, and he said, well, you know, they can be used for any end. You just have to make sure they're used the right way. But it's still stunning to see both sides of the coin. You know, it could be used positively and negatively, but when it's used negatively, it's a scary thing.
So today, when we hear people say that they want candidates, for example, to talk about issues, they may want to hear about issues on a conscious level. Hmm. But what Bernays was saying, and I think that it probably still holds true today, is that voters, would-be voters, are still making decisions with their heart rather than their head.
That's exactly what he was saying. It was the subconscious, as Freud said. You're not thinking, you don't even know what you actually want. You're blinded to it. And so Bernays, and it's one of the stories I talk about in the book, is how politicians can use very specific language to basically signal to people an emotional aspect of what their campaign is about. And so Ronald Reagan, for example, during the 1980s, he hired Lee Atwater to run his campaign. And they were trying to convince racist voters, to be frank, to support the campaign. And so instead of being explicitly racist and outright racist, they were very subtle. And so you can look back and you see, you know, the welfare queen, the strapping young buck, all these very subtle references to race that Reagan used over and over again. And that was by design. And so that's a Bernaysian way of signaling to people on an emotional level, irrespective of whether you're even aware of it or not, that here's what I stand for. And that very approach to government, I think, really was the dominant means of influence throughout the latter half of the 19th century or the 20th century.
It wasn't just Reagan. It was, I think about George H.W. Bush, the Willie Horton ad that many people point to, Bill Clinton.
Same thing.
Bill Clinton was, we'll give an example of Bill Clinton because many people think of Bill Clinton as a liberal.
Well, and I should note too that this is kind of irrespective of policy ideas. I mean, all these men recognized that this was a very successful way to win a national election. And so Clinton really did the same thing as Bush and Reagan. He hired Dick Morris in the 90s to run his campaign strategy. And he, for example, learned that many parents were terrified of their children watching pornography on TVs. And so he went and during his national address to Congress talked about putting these blocks into televisions, which he actually, you know, couldn't do. But it was an emotional way to connect with people on issues that ultimately didn't quite matter, but that people were concerned about. And, you know, one of the funny stories is that they thought by dressing Clinton up in, hunting gear and filming him out, you know, shooting at a duck, that he might be able to convince some more middle-class voters. I'm not quite sure it worked, but it's that kind of very artificial appeal on an emotional level to connect with voters.
Don't people have responsibility, though?
They do. That's a good point, Scott. But, you know, it's one of those things that goes back to education. You know, if you don't even really know that this is happening, you know, one of the things that you learn through education is to constantly question, right? Is to be skeptical of dogmatism, to be willing to admit when you're wrong and to acknowledge a good idea coming from someone that you might disagree with. Those are the takeaways from really a liberal arts education. But if you don't have that educational background, if you don't have hope, if you don't have the means to give yourself a sustainable livelihood, then all of these kind of extraneous means of influence become much more successful because you lack the ability to see through it. And so it's really, in large part, a failure across the board to emphasize education and to give everyone equal access to education so that they can learn for themselves what policy ideas are and what the specific effects are of those ideas.
I have to say, though, that one of the things I'm thinking of as you're talking about that is that you're talking about creative thinking. You're talking about thinking that someone thinks for themselves and ask, well, why? Why is this way? Or how did you do that? Or why are you telling me this? Looking for motives. in our education system today, especially in public education, over the last 20 years, there has been such an emphasis on, say, standardized tests. And one of the complaints from so many people who are critics of that, including teachers, in fact, most teachers, is that it does not foster creative thinking. So I don't know whether you address this in the book or not, but that creative thinking seems to be what you're describing that we're lacking.
That's exactly it. And I don't address it in the book, but I think that's a perfect example of forcing people into a box, right? You're defining for them what the product of their education should look like instead of allowing them to create it themselves and to learn through their own experience. And so I think standardized testing is a good example of that. The purpose of education is to create awareness, not to standardize. And that's what I learned, at least through a liberal arts education and specifically studying, you know, philosophy, is that this takes time. It's difficult, but you learn through mistakes and you learn through discussion and empathizing with people and taking their perspective. And it's really one of those things that you learn the more you do and that you become better at it. But I don't think you can cabin it to a test.
Dale Carnegie. Now, Dale Carnegie has been held up as almost a hero in this country, but you have him as a bit of a villain, I guess, if you would describe him that way.
I wouldn't call him a villain.
Okay, maybe not villain. That's going a little bit too far. But not held up there with the respect that he gets in the influence that he has on people. But no, he does influence a lot of people in your book.
His book is called How to Win Friends and Influence People. Yeah, no. Carnegie is like I said last time, a little tough on Carnegie maybe, but I think the point of contrast you have to draw is to look first at what influence looked like for the founders. So I think a good example of this is John Quincy Adams wrote a book on how to persuade, and persuasion for John Quincy Adams meant influencing people through proof. You had to show them facts. You had to show them why you were doing something and what the effects of your decision would be. And it's a difficult thing to do. And I think if you look back in the 1830s, when the great triumvirate of Henry Clay and Daniel Webster and John C. Calhoun were in the Senate, they had perfected this oral advocacy. But it took a lot of time to do so. But it rested on the premise that to convince someone on the merit of an idea, you have to show them facts. What Carnegie does, and you have to remember the context in which he was writing, which was 1936, when unemployment was at 16.9%. It was the nadir of the Great Depression. And he was trying to give people confidence again, to say that you have the power to control your employment destiny in a capitalistic society. But his method of influence, in my judgment at least, is more about creating an external image. You're selling yourself. You're not really selling your idea. It's not about character. It's not about virtue. It's about, you know, smiling to make a good first impression. You know, maybe putting a Hershey Kiss in somebody's drawer to surprise them and to develop a good relationship so they buy something from you. It's purely transactional. It's not deeper than that. And I think if you look at social media today, it's a perfect illustration of that approach. Social media is essentially creating an external image of yourself. I wouldn't say that it's authentic, but it's the way that we influence one another today. The biggest influencers are online. And that external image construction, I think, comes from the Carnegie premise that you have to sell yourself. You're not selling an idea itself, but you're selling what you are representing to other people. And in my view, it's not the correct way to engage in meaningful conversations about the merits of an idea. And I think it's carried over into politics, where we now have politicians trying to influence us through these external image construction, as opposed to having, you know, like Lincoln at Cooper Union, 3-hour debates about the merits of slavery or the most important issues of the day. We just don't see that anymore. And I think in order for democracy to really return to what the founders envisioned, we have to return to what John Quincy Adams prioritized, and that's influencing each other through proof.
I can't help, because I know that today everything is viewed through the context of Donald Trump. Mm. And I couldn't help thinking as I'm reading your book that a lot of what you're describing, a lot of what you're criticizing, that it exists during the Trump era. Was that part of your thinking at all?
It was. I don't mention Donald Trump in the book.
Not once, no.
Because I don't think I need to. I think Donald Trump is clearly the symptom and not the cause. You know, this is 40 years in the making of conning voters. I firmly believe that. It's turned into an entertainment industry. And now we have somebody who a few years ago was wrestling WWE running the country because he learned how to run an entertainment show. And the really saddening part about it is that the people who identified with Donald Trump have legitimate grievances. And he said that, you know, we have to help the people who have been forgotten. The middle class has been decimated. We've basically become an elitist class. We have the 1% and everybody else. And so his message resonated, and it was very powerful. And I think we have to remember the reason that he won was because of the situation that we find ourselves in now with radical inequality. But he sold America on that idea illegitimately. And I think it's by looking at history and looking to why politics has morphed into this kind of entertainment industry that lacks any real genuine substance. And I think Donald Trump is the ultimate product of that. And we're seeing and living with it today. And finally, I think we're realizing that this is not what government looks like. And so that's why I returned to the founders, is to say, okay, we need a course correction. We've gone off track. What can we do to right the ship here? And the founders specifically tell us, it's in plain English, we have to return to education. We have to pursue the common good. We have to look out for one another and stop dedicating ourselves to material accumulation and instead pursue communal advancement and what can help your neighbor and your family and your friends and yourself. But that has to be a communal effort.
Thomas Breyer Jr. is the author of the book, While Reason Slept. Tom, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on Monday, Smart Talk, we discuss human trafficking in Pennsylvania. There's been some laws, a few laws that have been enacted that have an impact on human trafficking, and there are others that are proposed as well. So that's our topic on Monday's show. In the years before the Civil War, people known as abolitionists were the most outspoken and passionate about ending slavery in the United States. The better-known abolitionists, like William Lloyd Garrison, published anti-slavery newspapers and often lived in New England, New York, or Philadelphia. South Central Pennsylvania was one of the first stops on the Underground Railroad on the way to freedom for many slaves, but it also was home to abolitionists as well. Cooper Wingert writes about them in his new book, Abolitionist of South Central Pennsylvania. Cooper Wingert, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. This is your 11th book, and you've written extensively about the Civil War era. Why abolitionism?
So I wrote previously, and we were on this program a couple of years ago, talking about the Underground Railroad. And I kind of started this book as a venture to explore the lives, the people, and the ideas that really powered the anti-slavery movement right here in South Central PA. So both abolitionists and fugitive slaves, and of course some of the national abolitionists who had some pretty important and interesting ties to this area.
How would you define abolitionism?
Well, that's kind of hard because abolitionists are a pretty diverse lot. They're often divided against each other, and they're often there's a lot of infighting that goes on. I would say you have religious abolitionists. People might fall under the Garrison camp of William Lloyd Garrison, who believe that the whole nation is kind of a sinful compact because that you know, any association with politics is being complicit with a nation that enables slaveholding. Then there are the political abolitionists, and we have both of these in South Central PA. The political abolitionists believe that the best way to get rid of slavery is to go through political means to achieve compromises. Sometimes you might call them more practical in that sense, and they think they see politics, amendments to the Constitution, as the best way to change slavery and ultimately end it.
Many people, as I mentioned in the introduction, like mm-hmm. William Lloyd Garrison, were from other parts of the country. Garrison was from Boston originally, but he did have some influence here in South yes. Central Pennsylvania. But if you would, kind of give a broad picture of what abolitionism was like here in South Central Pennsylvania. I mean, we're going to talk on sure. a county-by-county basis here mm-hmm. in a few minutes, but overall, what was it like?
So one of the big things about the abolitionist movement is coinciding with this in the 1830s is the spread of newspapers. The number of newspapers in America at this point is just multiplying. I think it's about threefold during this era. And abolitionist newspapers, you know, Garrison has his own newspaper. Eventually, Frederick Douglass has his own newspaper. There's a National Anti-Slavery Standard. There's a Pennsylvania Freeman, which is a newspaper just for abolitionists within Pennsylvania. And this is how they communicate their ideas. They kind of raise the alarm about different incidents. So the newspapers, and there's a lot of subscribers for them right here in South Central PA, are crucial to helping to spread this movement.
I mentioned, and you write in the book, about Garrison being mm-hmm. influenced by someone here in the region. Talk about that.
Well, indirectly. There's a black barber in Carlisle named John Peck, and actually it's a Dickinson College student named James Miller McKim who goes into his barber shop. And Peck is basically a Garrisonian agent. So he is a free African-American man living in Carlisle in the 1820s and 1830s. He is selling subscriptions for Garrison's newspaper. And in his barber shop, he also has copies of several of Garrison's publications. And he convinces this young man, James Miller McKim, of the merits of abolitionism. He loans him copies of Garrison's publications. McKim is convinced, and he later goes on to become a somewhat successful abolitionist lecturer, but he ends up, his most important role is behind the scenes as a leading officer in the Pennsylvania Abolition Society. So he goes on to quite an important role in the abolitionist movement for several decades.
Just like to think about that and picture that, you know, we traditionally or historically have thought about barbershops as a place where there's gossip spread. We talk
yes.
about the issues of the day. There's joking going on, a game mm-hmm. of checkers or chess, something like that. But here's a real example. In the 1820s and 1830s, a barbershop in Carlisle where a free African-American that where history is made in so many ways.
Exactly. Yeah, it's quite remarkable. Mm-hmm.
So I want to go on to some of the other people that you mentioned in the book. Who is Benjamin Lundy?
So Benjamin Lundy is probably the most famous abolitionist that you've never heard of. So before William Lloyd Garrison, the most famous, the most household recognized abolitionist would have been Benjamin Lundy. So he's kind of odd among abolitionists in that he believes in setting up shop in the South, which isn't always the best idea.
Sounds kind of dangerous too.
It is, yeah. He sets up shop in Tennessee, and then later he moves to Baltimore, and he has this paper called The Genius of Universal Emancipation. We're talking the late 18-teens, early 1820s. And one of his apprentices is William Lloyd Garrison. Garrison is more of a vocal, somewhat you might say radical voice. He's calling for immediate emancipation. Lundy is kind of the more gentle, persuasive, you know, trying to convince Southerners that it's in their economic interest to get rid of slavery. And ultimately, it's Garrison who kind of goes back to Boston and starts his own paper, The Liberator, which is that very demonstrative, kind of the demagogue style of slavery has to end now. This is a national, sin. Whereas Lundy preferred to kind of cajole slaveholders more and try to, you know, appeal to their better senses. But ultimately, Garrison, you know, is the way that we kind of look at abolitionists now.
So Lundy and his ties to South Central Pennsylvania?
So Lundy has, he is from a fairly large Quaker family in New Jersey, and his half-sister actually moves to Adams County. She marries an Adams County abolitionist in and around the town that's known today as York Springs.
And Adams County, as you write in the book, Adams County becomes kind of a hotbed for
exactly.
abolitionism, but and Quakers too. That would seem to make a lot of sense
mm-hmm.
Because Quakers from the time of William Penn and Pennsylvania's founding, slavery wasn't something that they endorsed and actually they fought against as it got closer to the Civil War period.
Now, Quakers themselves don't abolish slavery until 1774 within their own ranks. However, they were one of the earliest religious organizations to come out against slavery, and certainly they are leading the opposition. There's a significant Quaker presence in Adams County at the time, but the Adams County abolitionists are also joined by free blacks, fugitive slaves, by all sorts of white men from different denominations, Presbyterians, Lutherans. So it's quite a kind of diverse movement in Adams County.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Adams County, because one of the things you do in the book is a few chapters. Mm-hmm. You break it down by county by county. Let's start with Adams County.
Okay.
So tell me about Adams County and the abolitionist in Adams County. I think you kind of established how it began.
Sure.
But if you would, talk about that.
Sure. So one of the kind of hallmarks of the history of anti-slavery movement in Adams County is the Adams County Anti-Slavery Society. Now, as far as we know, this was an all-white male group. They hold several meetings in the late 1830s, but they're very public initially. They hold different lectures throughout the town of Gettysburg. They're trying to instigate this conversation, and it doesn't go very well at all. One of their meetings in Gettysburg is broken up by a pro-slavery mob. There are a whole bunch of things thrown at them. There's rotten eggs, tomatoes, and even a dead cat was thrown at them. So the resistance to them is pretty strong. And they kind of just fall off the map after 1840. And what they kind of did is they adopted new tactics, which was instead of being so public, they started kind of, we might call underground resistance, not to be too cliche, to slavery. And they were often helping fugitive slaves who came through Gettysburg because it's only a few miles north of the Maryland border.
Mm-hmm. And you describe a lot in and around the Gettysburg area. Mm-hmm. And again, there's some a little bit of irony there in that, the most important battle of the Civil War fought
yes.
In 1863 in Gettysburg, but yet it was within maybe 10, 15 miles of the center of Gettysburg, where there's all this abolitionist activity that was going on. As I mentioned, you write kind of on a county-by-county basis.
Mm-hmm.
What about Franklin, York, and Cumberland counties? Let's take it kind of one by one.
Sure. So Franklin County is probably the most fraught county for fugitive slaves and freedom seekers, particularly because there's a strong presence of slave catchers in the county, partly because they can come straight up from Hagerstown.
But can we stop for just
sure.
one second? Let's take a step back.
Sure.
Slave catchers, 1850 fugitive slave law.
Sure.
Talk about that a little bit, and that will explain what slave catchers are.
So slave catchers kind of were a lot of times they operated somewhat illegally before the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law. After 1850, the Fugitive Slave Act provides kind of a streamlined or more efficient process for Southerners. It basically legalizes slave catching. And slave catchers do thrive in Franklin County. They often are opposed by African American communities, but there's no doubt that within South Central PA, the most dangerous county for fugitive slaves was Franklin County. There's more reports of slave catching there than anywhere else.
And to explain the fugitive slave law, it was legal after 1850 for African Americans to be captured and sent back to slavery in the South.
In theory, it was always legal going back to the Fugitive Slave Clause in the U.S. Constitution, but the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 it knocks away a lot of the impediments that northern states had built in with these so-called personal liberty laws. So it makes it a lot more easy for Southerners to reclaim fugitive slaves or recapture, sometimes in some cases, free African Americans who end up being enslaved.
So Franklin County, there were a lot of slave catchers in Franklin County. What about abolitionists?
There are some abolitionists. There's a pocket in Quincy, which is in the southeastern corner of Franklin County. One of the abolitionist lecturers I profile, he was from Vermont, a man named Jonathan Blanchard. When he's touring Franklin County, that's one of the pockets that he finds there. He does get a warm reception, whereas otherwise he's often mobbed throughout the rest of Franklin County. There are even some abolitionists in Chambersburg. Probably one of the most famous is Henry Watts, or I should say the most important is a barber named Henry Watts, and we have another barber influential in the anti-slavery movement. Watson eventually will be coordinating a visit when Frederick Douglass comes to Chambersburg in 1859.
York and Cumberland counties.
York, again, is another county where there's a lot of pro-slavery sentiment. One of the biggest, most influential abolitionist is a black businessman named William Goodridge, who is one of the wealthiest men in York. He has the largest or the tallest building in York at the time, and he has connections to abolitionists to the east in Lancaster County.
Mm-hmm. And Cumberland County?
Cumberland County, it's kind of hard to say. There are a lot of abolitionists within Carlisle. There's a very famous fugitive slave riot in 1847 where a Dickinson College professor named John McClintock is accused of inciting free African Americans to riot to help free some fugitive slaves. In fact, a slaveholder is killed during the incident. But I would say probably Carlisle was the biggest pocket of abolitionist sentiment. You also have further to the south in Boiling Springs, there's an abolitionist named Daniel Kaufman who ends up being fined $5,000 for helping shelter runaway slaves.
Abolitionists were unpopular with many people throughout mm-hmm. the country, even some who opposed slavery because they saw them as rabble-rousers. Franklin County seemed to have its share of, you write about a publication, newspaper, mm-hmm. that was very much blaming abolitionists for all the tension in the country.
Yeah, they were incredibly anti-abolitionist. They, you know, where we talk about abolitionists are holding meetings and lectures, and in Chambersburg, they actually have an anti-abolition meeting denouncing abolitionism. They have a similar one, a similar warning that is issued by prominent citizens in Carlisle saying we don't want abolitionists in our community. They cause disruption. They make our many people in South Central PA had relatives in the South. They had business ties to the South, and they did not welcome kind of the what they viewed as the divisiveness of abolitionism.
John Brown planned his raid on Harper's Ferry mm-hmm. that was meant to incite a slave revolt. He planned it in Chambersburg. What were some of the circumstances surrounding that?
So John Brown, he, for those of you who don't know, he's the abolitionist. Before, in 1856, he had been in Kansas, and he had been really involved in the murder of several pro-slavery leaders in the Kansas Territory, so-called Bleeding Kansas. So he comes to Pennsylvania, and he's grown a long white beard by this time. He's trying to disguise his identity, and he's kind of an odd fellow. He goes around Chambersburg under a pseudonym of Isaac Smith. Sometimes he changes it to other names. And he's kind of marshaling resources in Chambersburg, also in Sharpsburg, Maryland, as he's planning this kind of raid. It's kind of odd, and we don't exactly know what his intentions were, but he was trying to open up some passageway along the Appalachian Mountains by which fugitive slaves could easily reach the north. It's kind of, you know, in retrospect, it seems very unrealistic, and it probably was. But Brown plans a lot of this with a lot of his abolitionist cohorts in Chambersburg. In fact, they stay at the boarding house of Mary Rittner, which is still open for visitors to tour.
What's the address of that? We actually have a photograph that was in your book on our website, WITF.org. Actually, there were a lot of people who suspected Mary of being in cahoots with John Brown or Isaac Smith.
Yeah, so Mary Rittner is the owner of this boarding house, and she is the daughter also of a former Pennsylvania governor who had been somewhat anti-slavery. And basically, she's pretty widely suspected after the raid goes up, after John Brown and many of his conspirators are captured, of having known about this. And frankly, she never admits to it, but frankly, she was someone who would have known many of the prominent figures in the anti-slavery movement. And I find it doubtful that she would not have, you know, after several months of on and off interaction with this man, not have figured out that it was John Brown and the fact that he had all sorts of people guarding his bedroom door. I think she would have surmise that it was more than your typical visitor.
And they were smuggling a lot of arms and materials that were going to go into the raid into Chambersburg as well.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things is Frederick Douglass, another national abolitionist, actually comes to Chambersburg to meet with Brown. And Henry Watson, this black barber I mentioned earlier, is kind of the liaison to arrange this meeting. And Frederick Douglass, supposedly, he claims that Brown had changed his plans drastically since the last time they had spoken. Douglass says, "I can't be involved in this." He gives him a bear hug and then never sees him again. And Douglass actually flees the country, fearing that he might be prosecuted in connection with the raid.
And John Brown is dead at the end of a hangman's
yes.
noose. Just a few months later, was hanged in Charlestown, West Virginia. Cooper Wengert, the book is Abolitionist of South Central Pennsylvania. We only have about 30 seconds left. Always enjoy your books. What do you want the takeaway to be for this? What do you want the reader to take away from it?
I would say I think this really goes into just what it took to launch a grassroots movement. I think I hope that it will resonate with people because these are places, towns and cities that we are familiar with. These are sometimes names, last names that we're familiar with too. So I hope that kind of the local connection helps put the broader abolitionist movement in kind of a closer to home.
I will agree with that, that a lot of the names that you read about in the book, you still recognize today, very families still involved here in South Central Pennsylvania. Cooper Wingert, thank you very much for being with us today. Coming up on Monday's program, we talk about human trafficking in Pennsylvania. Have yourself a great weekend.